Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
I was at a wedding where people had had a little too much to drink, and the groom got into a fist fight with his cousin, and the police were called. The fighting went out into the parking lot, and he did not go home with his wife that night.
From the embarrassing to the cataclysmic, we all have wedding stories, and we swap them like stories of schoolyard crushes and where we got that scar.
I have a wedding that I was invited to and I didn't go, and it, to this day, it just makes me so sad that I wasn't there, because it was my great uncle Jack, and he, all his life, has been a professional clown, Robo the Clown. And this is his second marriage, so he had a marriage that didn't work out, and then a few years later he met a woman, and she was also a clown, and they had a clown wedding. They were dressed as clowns, the guy who officiated the wedding was dressed as a clown, and everybody in the audience, including my, at the time, like, 75-year-old grandfather, was dressed as a clown.
So the bride didn't wear white, she wore a rainbow.
Oh, it was multicolored.
Did the entire wedding party arrive in a mini and then all pile out of it?
Oh, man, that would have been good. I don't think they came up with that.
I don't want to say it's a bad wedding, because it was a good wedding, and people will hear this that might have gone to it. It was a medieval wedding. It was straight out of Game of Thrones. So there was a roasted pig on a spit. My mom made me a tunic. I had a recorder that I had in fourth grade from music class that I stuck in my belt. And
was there a falcon there that came down and brought the ring?
That would have been awesome. Or a dragon.
You know what the good thing about a Ren Faire-themed wedding is?
Nothing.
No silverware?
I was going to say it's got to be way cheaper.
I don't know. Some people were in full armor.
I don't have a bad wedding story. I mean, there are sort of...
crazy wedding story?
There are some raging weddings that I've been to through the years. But my best wedding story is actually a sweet wedding story. A wedding... my sister's wedding is where I met my boyfriend. My sister Denise, being a good sister, invited several single dancing partners for me. And so Eric happened to have been one of those dancing partners, and he was a damn good dancer, too.
Swept you right off your feet, Virginia.
He did. And that is what today's show is all about, the matrimonial journey from I do to I don't. So the usher will escort you to the appropriate side of the aisle. Take your seat, because the ceremony is about to begin. Whether disastrous or delightful, everyone loves a wedding, or at the very least, is obliged to attend one. And for the most part, American weddings tend to have the same moving parts: engagement, engagement announcement, engagement party, invitation, engagement ring, white gown, flowers, food, signature drink, gift registry, bridesmaids, bridesmaids' dresses that look good on all of them, groomsmen, groomsmen attire, ceremonial vows, rings, reception, champagne toast, more drinking, cutting of the cake, dancing, bouquet toss. But it was not always this way. In fact, in the early to mid-19th century, weddings were private affairs. Joining me now to provide more insight into the history of American weddings is Carol Wallace, author of many books, including How to Marry an English Lord and All Dressed in White, The Irresistible Rise of the American Wedding. Carol Wallace, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much, Virginia. I'm happy to be talking to you about one of my absolute favorite subjects.
Well, I can tell. As we mentioned, weddings used to be private affairs, but was that for both the upper and lower classes?
Yes, it is. Partly for the lower classes, because there wasn't a lot of wherewithal to be making a big party. But also, in the 19th century, there was one really important factor that people didn't like to take public, which is that if you're talking about weddings, you're talking about sex. Just the idea of this was something that families wanted to really hold close and not expose to other people.
So your book starts in mid-19th century New York City. What would it have been like to attend an upper-crust wedding in the 1840s or 50s?
It would have been interestingly similar to a wedding today, in as much as you would have a bride, most likely in a white dress. You would have her family around her. You would have the groom's family. There would be an officiant, most always a minister of some kind. And after the ceremony, there would be a party with a cake. The big differences would be scale and also privacy. Weddings were normally held at home, often in the nicest room of the house, and there would be a lot less fuss than there is today. Often a wedding could be planned, this is going to be an earth-shaking idea, a wedding could be planned in as little as a couple of weeks. And people who were supposed to be there were simply summoned for often tea, maybe punch, and of course the cake.
How about the wedding reception? When did that become fashionable, along with all of its rituals, the garter belt, the bouquet toss, that kind of thing?
Oh, well, the garter belt and the bouquet toss are much, much later, because to go back to the sex question, which you really cannot get away from, that's really a post-World War II phenomenon. The bouquet toss occurs as early as the turn of the 20th century, but it's not that widespread. Weddings were really pretty buttoned up and quiet until the beginning of the 20th century, and then they sort of gradually become more and more like a party, and the introduction of liquor is a pretty big deal. And in fact, the whole big blossoming of the white wedding as a big party that involves a lot of people doesn't happen until after World War II, and that's when the wedding industry really gets launched.
So why?
Partly because industry explodes then. One of the biggest things, strangely enough, is the enormous growth of mass market dresses, not just wedding dresses, but mass market, all kinds of manufacturing clothes. But it's also a time when our economy was going very strong and a wedding became a status symbol, a big fancy wedding. There's a kind of trickle-down effect because high society girls are getting married. Their weddings are being covered in the newspapers and magazines. So you start to see this pattern of these big society weddings that show up in the media, and everyone starts to do a copycat thing. Mm-hmm. And that's how the white wedding sifts all the way down society.
We're speaking with Carol Wallace about the irresistible rise of the American wedding, as is the subtitle of her book, All Dressed in White. Well, let's look at the other side of the tracks in the mid-19th century. This is before the Industrial Revolution. America is still largely rural. Now, how did a country wedding compare to a big city wedding?
Oh, it was simplicity itself. Very often, a girl would wear her best dress, which very often was black, because one tradition there was no shaking was a black dress for a funeral. And people died. People died a lot in the Victorian era, in the mid-19th century. So every woman would have had a serviceable and relatively fashionable black dress, and she would simply dress it up for her wedding with white lace or perhaps with a little bit of artificial orange blossom. The other strictly immovable issue is the cake. There is always a cake. Hmm. But beyond the officiant and the groom, of course, and the cake and some kind of gesture toward festivity, things could be very simple indeed. You could be married just with your family. You could be married even without your family.
Okay, we're going to catapult forward, Carol, to contemporary weddings. According to the Wedding Report, couples spent an average of $25,200 on weddings in 2013. That is everybody. This is an average. So being wealthy is no longer a prerequisite. Now, how did we get here? Why did families of lower means adopt these expensive traditions?
Part of it is a copycat, for sure. If you look at any of the wedding magazines, there's a lot of showiness. There's the Tiffany box wedding cake. There's the gigantic diamond. There's three dresses. And we're an aspirational society. So very often the standards are set by media figures and a bride thinks, well, this is what I need to have too. That's one point. Point two is the industry is never going to say no. People are always going to want to sell you more stuff. And there's a sense in which once you get on to the wedding merry-go-round, it is really, really tough to get off. Mm. If you say you go to a florist and you say, I need wedding flowers, they are going to just take the ball and run with it. And very often zeros do get added to the prices, not just for florists, but for all kinds of vendors. So there's a kind of, it's a consumerist thing, and it's an aspirational thing, and it's also that I think it's hard to carve out options. In many cases, it's just easier to say yes and go with it.
You write in your book about some of the kind of traditions that we have been sold, you know, that we're told that these are things you must do at a wedding. What are some examples of those things that really never existed?
Okay, for example, the engagement ring itself is, it's a kind of jewelry lobby sort of thing. I mean, I don't even want to get started on the diamond industry, but there's a moment in the 1920s to 30s when the formal wedding starts to become more available to, let's say, the middle class. And there are all these etiquette hurdles having to do with, for example, what a proper invitation should look like or what a wedding gift ought to be. Wedding presents were not necessarily as elaborate as they are now when the whole wedding thing started. And it turned out that the sources for information about what a wedding ought to look like turned out to be the stores themselves. Department stores sort of got in on the act and started offering wedding lists, marriage lists, wedding registries, and they would offer the possibility of having your invitations engraved, and you would have wedding planners who, when the position of the wedding planner was invented, it was in the department stores. So in a way, a lot of these sort of landmarks like the shower or like...
Or the two-month salary on an engagement ring.
Oh, my gosh. The two-month salary on the engagement ring. 2 months, yes, exactly. Or when I married, there was a thing where in your parents' house, your wedding presents would be on display. And there were people who made their livings setting up that wedding present display, which is kind of amazing. That doesn't happen anymore, does it?
Well, let's hope not. And for guests, a new American Express study found that the average cost to attend a wedding is surging to $592, not including a gift, up to 75% from just 2 years ago. Do you think at some point, you know, people are just going to say, enough, we're not going to do this anymore? Are you seeing people bucking the whole matrimonial industrial complex, for lack of a better word?
I have been waiting for this to happen, Virginia, honestly, and it hasn't yet. I really do not know why. Perhaps because it is so much harder to go it alone than simply to buckle under and do what you're told by, as you call it, the wedding industrial complex. But surely there has to be an end to this somewhere.
Carol Wallace, a pleasure speaking with you.
Thanks so much, Virginia. I enjoyed it. Bye-bye.
Carol Wallace, author of several books, including How to Marry an English Lord and All Dressed in White, The Irresistible Rise of the American Wedding. To see photographs of 19th century frontier weddings and brides wearing black, visit our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Now, if you'd like to avoid all the hoopla and shelling out big bucks for your wedding day, you can always head to Vegas and elope. But before there was Vegas, there was Elkton, Maryland. Word of Mouth visits the former quickie wedding capital after the break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. With an average of nearly 100,000 marriage licenses issued annually, Las Vegas is known as the wedding capital of the world. But before there was Vegas, there was Elkton, Maryland. Producers Nell Beschenstein and Kelly Libby took a trip to this tiny town to find out more about its former life as the country's capital of elopement.
On the second floor of a small stone building along the main street in Elkton, Maryland, a bride stands in front of a full-length mirror, making sure her veil has not messed up her hair.
How are you feeling?
I feel like I'm a little nervous. Butterflies.
Yeah.
Ever since she was little, Amanda Herkner has known the little wedding chapel is where she'd eventually tie the knot. A church or courthouse in her home state of Pennsylvania was never in the cards.
My mom and my stepdad got married here, and my their grandparents got married here, and my aunt and my uncle got married here as well.
While family tradition may have been what brought her here, if you go back to the 1930s, the opposite would have been true. That was when couples flocked to Elkton to buck tradition, not honor it.
The street is full of parked cars and the buzz with people as the lights illuminate the night.
That's Mike Dixon. He works for the Cecil County Historical Society, and he's showing us a photo of Elkton's main drag in the 1930s. You can see the street glowing with signage, advertising chapels and ministers. The story of Elkton's boom days begins in the early years of the 20th century. As a generation of young people tested the limits of parental authority, quickie weddings were on the rise. In an effort to curtail the unsavory trend, state legislators had begun making couples wait at least 48 hours between applying for a marriage license and getting one. In 1913, Delaware became the latest in a string of northeastern states to implement such a rule.
Those couples who couldn't wait 2 days to get hitched saw a road around the new laws. That road led to Elkton, just 5 miles south of the Delaware state line. In Maryland, there wasn't a residency requirement or a waiting period.
Of course, Delaware's not that big, so it wouldn't generate the volume.
Again, Mike Dixon.
But it's New York, New Jersey, Camden, Trenton, Philadelphia. So it was really geography that's doing it to us. You know, we're the first place in Maryland that you can easily get to from the urban areas north of us, and then you can get married and you can get out of town.
Within a few years, 15 chapels had set up shop along the town's main strip. The number of weddings skyrocketed from 300 in 1913 to 36,000 in 1936. That's more than 10 times the population of Elkton itself.
So it's enormous. And what it was doing was it was bringing, like, some days there were 100 couples getting off that train. So the cab companies see a business opportunity, and I'm always amazed at how entrepreneurial they were.
Those cabs would bring couples to get a marriage license, then deliver them to a chapel, wait outside while the couple said their vows, and then return the Mr. and Mrs. in time to catch the afternoon train home. While the rest of the country struggled through the Depression, business in Elkton was gangbusters. Of course, not everybody was happy about the industry behind the town's economic boom.
We were a state-owned Methodist Presbyterian Episcopal minister, and you're looking at these fast marriages. It's not what you approve of, you know? And, you know, certainly the Roman Catholic Church is not going to approve of these things. And they would do everything they could to kill it off, or regulate it.
Ordinance after ordinance was proposed to constrain the wedding trade. Some were targeted at the cab companies, other at the explosion of street signs pointing the way to the chapels. Local business leaders were able to defeat these laws. Unfortunately for them, there were larger factors at play.
Good morning. Stop that music.
This is a scene from the Philadelphia story, which came out in 1940.
Dexter, what next?
2 years ago, I did you out of a wedding in this house by eloping to Maryland.
2 years ago?
Thanks to Elkton, eloping to Maryland had entered the cultural lexicon. The entire state was being tarred by the town's tawdry reputation.
Which was very bad manners.
And so state lawmakers took matters into their own hands. In 1938, they passed a 48-hour waiting period.
To quote the Evening Sun, I think they said a melancholy gloom descended over Elkton's matrimonial magnates.
The town never really recovered. Marrying couples continued to come, but more out of nostalgia than need. Which brings us back to Amanda, the current day bride in Elkton.
Downstairs, the wedding party and minister have taken their places. Within minutes, the bride has made her entrance.
Will you, Charles, have this woman to be your lawful wedded wife, to live together in the covenant of marriage?
With that, Amanda's family tradition continues. But there's a decent chance it will end with her. The little wedding chapel is the last remaining chapel from Elkton's heyday, and it's for sale. So far, its owners haven't found a buyer willing to perform weddings there. which means that Elkton's matrimonial history may soon be reduced to just another historical marker on just another street, in just another town, off I-95.
And that story came to us from the radio show and podcast Backstory with the American History Guys.
What is this thing called love? This funny thing called love.
Word of Mouth continues its matrimonial journey with a look at a growing trend among the soon-to-be betrothed, the unplugged wedding. Why couples are insisting guests turn off their cell phones. After the news.
I saw you there one wonderful day. You took my heart and threw it away. That's why I asked the Lord.
Word of
Mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Well, definitely. Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Not so long ago, wedding attendants needed to make sure they had one thing on hand: tissues. Nowadays, your great aunt Mabel and Uncle George are armed with iPhones and flip cams. With everybody clamoring for digital keepsakes, wedding ceremonies are increasingly turning into flashing galleries of amateur paparazzi. Joining me now to discuss the unplugged wedding trend is Ariel Meadow Starlings, author of Offbeat Bride, Creative Alternatives for Independent Brides. She's also founder and publisher of the Offbeat Bride website. Ariel, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Now, you started Offbeat Bride back in 2007. When did you start hearing complaints about cameras, and maybe even not cameras, iPhones and iPads at weddings?
Yeah, you know, I think it's something that I first started hearing more and more about in 2010 when iPhones started to be ubiquitous, right? It started to be people having smartphones who weren't just nerds like those of us who work on the internet. And it started to be more of an issue both for couples planning their weddings and looking at their wedding photos after the fact and seeing the photos filled with their friends and family staring into screens. But I also started hearing about it a lot from wedding photographers who were starting to have trouble capturing the moments that they had been paid, sometimes at significant cost, to capture because there was what wedding photographers call Uncle Bob. Uncle Bob would be standing in the middle of the aisle trying to take his own photo, and the photographer who was there being paid to take the picture wasn't being able to get the shot.
Well, and it's not just the taking of the photographs. It's social media platforms, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. How do they play into this issue?
Yeah, you know, I think this is kind of an expression of just where we are as a culture right now, where we've shifted into a place where we're really into documentation and capturing the moment via social media and via photos and sort of this real-time social media experience, which is great. I mean, I'm a nerd. I love social media. I love being connected to people all over the world. But I think we're wrestling in a lot of ways culturally with when it feels appropriate to be engaged with social media and when it's actually detracting from our ability to be present in the moment that we're actually in.
Right. So you've got your guests taking photographs and then looking at their phones down at their screens while they're uploading it to their social media sites. But let's get back to this Uncle Bob or Aunt Mabel idea. Now, weddings are full of etiquette, and there's always somebody who gets mad about something. Is it rude to forbid people from innocently snapping photographs?
Yeah, you know, I think the place where I see the least pushback, because, of course, everyone loves to argue etiquette and what's rude and what's not, and, you know, is anything rude if you ask respectfully? Are you just respecting the couple for whatever they ask, whatever it may be? Please wear orange shoes. Please don't use your camera. And I think the place where there seems to be the least pushback is couples who ask people not to use their devices at the ceremony. People are less understanding, and I hear more friction from guests when it comes to the reception, right? This is basically a party. People don't want to be told, you know, that they can't have their phone out at a party. So the place where it seems to be the most acceptable is just to say, you know, during the ceremony, this is a this is a sacred time. Please leave your devices turned off and in your bags.
Would you actually put that on the invitation?
You know, I'm seeing people not use it in the invitation as much, but more on wedding websites and in the programs so that it's something that's conveyed once you're at the wedding. Or sometimes people will have little signs up outside the ceremony space saying, you know, hey, leave it in your bag.
What's interesting to me, Ariel, is that your website, Offbeat Bride, emphasizes the DIY approach, you know, offering couples inspired and affordable ideas for weddings. Professional wedding photographers, of course, are expensive. Now, aren't guests simply creating a wedding album free of charge when they take their own photos?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think I do want to clarify that Offbeat Bride isn't actually about encouraging people to be DIY. It's about encouraging people to be authentic to whatever their personality and their vision is. That said, I love seeing the range from we hired a photographer, we asked no one else to take photos because we love that photographer's work and we wanted them to have free reign, unfettered, all the way to what we think of as crowdsourcing your wedding photography, which is saying, hey, our friends and family are coming with their cameras. We love their photos. We're going to use an app or a web service like Flickr to collect those photos. And those are our wedding pictures. So I think whichever way people go, we support them either way.
I wonder if that would also be advising the photographer. I went to a wedding recently where the professional photographers took very little photos of the bride's mother. Thank goodness that other people who were guests did. Isn't there something kind of fun about seeing the wedding from a friend's perspective?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's the best argument for having guests take photos is that, God forbid, something happens with the photographer, the images don't come through, their memory card fails, they go out of business, that you have the insurance of backup photos from guests. And alternately, some people just love, like you've said, kind of this more candid guest perspective. For some people, looking out into the crowd of assembled guests and seeing everyone looking through screens is going to be frustrating and dispiriting. For other people who are social media mavens and love their own gadgets, they might be reading their vows off of an iPad and looking out and seeing that super wired moment where everyone's looking through their viewfinders might be super just a great celebration of technology and where they're at in their lives.
Ariel Meadows-Stallings, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
Ariel Meadows-Stallings is the author of Offbeat Bride, Creative Alternatives for Independent Brides, and founder and publisher of the Offbeat Bride website. We have a link to view it for yourself and look at this trend in unplugged weddings. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. When word of mouth continues, the unfortunate outcome for many American marriages, divorce. While divorce proceedings are complicated and wrenching for anybody, it's a particularly arduous process for same-sex couples. A look into the legal barriers for gay divorce that make even something as complicated as same-sex marriage relatively simple. That's when word of mouth continues.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Robin Townsend is a graphic designer living in Pennsylvania. She met the woman who would become her wife in the late 2000s through a mutual friend. They bonded over yoga, not just as a form of exercise, but as a lifestyle.
She was vegetarian, mostly. Good sense of humor, very smart, intelligent, funny, vivacious. Those kind of things were attractive at first.
At first. Today on the show, we've been talking all about weddings, but as you may have guessed, this is not a story about happily ever after. But we'll get to that.
Yeah, we got married at the Land's End Inn.
That's the Land's End Inn in Provincetown, Massachusetts.
And it was a beautiful place.
Which is good, because they couldn't get married at home. At that time, the state of Pennsylvania still had a ban against same-sex marriage, which coincidentally was just lifted this week.
It was a lot of layers there, because there was the I'm in love and I have a partner, and yet this is such an exciting time because we're making change.
Now remember back in 2008, President Obama was still against same-sex marriage. The Defense of Marriage Act had yet to be struck down, Prop 8 had just passed in California, and Massachusetts was the only state where gay couples could legally tie the knot. Robin and Holly were not just making vows. They were making history, but history alone does not a marriage make.
I think what's interesting is, like, in hindsight, you kind of look back and you're like, oh, those were kind of red flags, which you didn't really see at first because you're so in love and you have, like, your love goggles on. You can't really see, like, the real truth of the person.
Well, it didn't work out. Robin said the split was triggered by a trip to India that ended badly. She also says that domestic violence was an issue, even before they were married. Whatever the cause, we didn't pursue Holly's side of the story, because this isn't about why they broke up. It's about why, like so many married same-sex couples, Robin and Holly can't get divorced, or couldn't, up until this week.
So when it came to leaving and looking for it, it was kind of, at first, it was freeing and just kind of able to breathe. And then after that, I started to realize, oh, there's no way out. Because when I pick up the phone in Pennsylvania and talk to lawyers, they basically have no idea what to tell me. And then I did call lawyers in Massachusetts and went to the courthouse in Massachusetts. And so I did feel pretty much like a ping pong ball, with going back and forth and back and forth. So here I am, a resident of Pennsylvania all my life. I've paid taxes to Pennsylvania all my life, state, federal, you name it, you know. And I can't get a divorce. I don't have the same rights as straight people do.
So we spoke to Robin last week as we were getting ready for this show. And on Monday, she spoke to a lawyer who was helping her navigate the obstacles that were preventing her divorce. And then, incredibly, on Tuesday, Pennsylvania lifted its ban on same-sex marriage, paving the way for gay couples to wed and, consequently, to split. So we thought, I guess that's the end of this story, but it isn't. Same-sex marriage is still banned by either constitutional amendment or state law in 32 other states. So the legal roadblocks that were true in Pennsylvania up until this week are still preventing same-sex couples from getting divorced all over the country. With that in mind, we turn to Tiffany Palmer. She's a Philadelphia attorney who specializes in, among other things, gay rights around adoption, marriage, and more recently, divorce. Hello, Tiffany.
Hi, how are you?
All right, but very interested in this sticky situation. So I'd like to ask you, in terms as plain as possible, why can't Robin get a divorce?
You know, that's a great question. And I think the thing that many same-sex couples and many people just in general don't realize is that while same-sex couples who are residents of Pennsylvania can leave Pennsylvania and get married in any of the 18 states that will provide marriage licenses to same-sex couples, the general rule in almost all states is that you can only get divorced in the state where you reside unless there is some sort of statutory exception in the state where you got your marriage license. And the general rule for all couples is that, you know, while you could, you know, go off to Nevada and get married and you could go have a destination wedding in California for, you know, straight couples, even Pennsylvania straight couples that marry in those states, they have to get divorced in the state where they reside. Huh. And that would be Pennsylvania.
And so the residency requirements, I guess, are part of the challenge here.
That's exactly. Residency requirements are pretty much standard in most divorce statutes. So, you know, for example, in Pennsylvania, you have to be a resident for 6 months in order to file a divorce in Pennsylvania. The real barrier for same-sex couples is that if a couple lives in a state that does not recognize same-sex marriage, they cannot file a divorce in the state where they reside. So that leaves them with trying to figure out, well, where can I get divorced? Well, for couples that married in Massachusetts, Massachusetts does not have a statutory exception that allows non-residents to go back and divorce there. So that means they can't get divorced in Pennsylvania and they can't get divorced in Massachusetts. So that means they can't get divorced unless one of them moves to another state.
Where can they get divorced then? If you say Massachusetts has a statute, is there going to be some, you know, destination like Reno, Nevada, where same-sex couples can get legally divorced?
Currently, there are only a few states that have enacted statutes that say they will retain jurisdiction for a divorce, even for non-residents. Washington, D.C., Delaware, California, there's a few states that are doing this, but a lot of people don't know that, and then they marry in a state that doesn't have one of those statutory exceptions.
But you would have had to get married in one of those states in order to be divorced even elsewhere, huh?
Exactly. Okay. In order to divorce as a non-resident, you would have had to marry in one of those states that allows non-residents to come back. So couples that married in a state that does not have a statutory exception, some of the most common ones are Massachusetts and New York. There's so many couples that are going to those two states. But neither of those states has a statutory exception, so that means they cannot divorce in the state where they married, and they cannot divorce in the state where they reside.
So we did hear from Robin. We admittedly got only her side about this relationship. So that's the emotional side. But legally, what is at stake for Robin in this waiting period? Or is there even a waiting period? Is there a goal at the end?
Yeah, it's a very tough situation. You know, we've received calls from hundreds of people in these types of situations. You know, there's a term that's been developed called wedlocked, that these couples are wedlocked. They're married and they can't get out. There's a lot at stake. There is a lot at stake. First of all, a lot of these people have entered into new relationships and they can't marry their new partner. So they can't remarry. One of the biggest things is federal taxation. So now same-sex married couples, even though they're separated, have to file their taxes as married filing jointly or married filing separately, which is a less favorable tax status many times than filing as single.
Right.
So they're financially commingled and stuck with this person.
What then is the solution? Federal legislation? Or will this go away as more and more states legalize gay marriage?
Yeah, there's really no way that this can be addressed through federal legislation because this is all a product of individual state divorce statutes where the federal government has no authority to regulate. So this is only going to change through individual states changing their state DOMAs to recognize same-sex marriage. In the meantime, you know, we are advising clients to actually move to another state, establish residency in order to get divorced. Many of our clients who live in southeastern or eastern Pennsylvania are actually moving to New Jersey, residing there for an entire year, and then they can file their divorce in New Jersey. We have quite a few clients who are pursuing that route.
Wow, that's a pretty dramatic response.
It is.
Is that what you advised Robin Townsend to do? Is she living out of state?
We had talked about that. I do not believe she's, you know, for some people, they're not able to do it. They have jobs. They have other relationships that it's just not necessarily a possibility. But for people that are facing significant barriers to moving on with their lives, sometimes moving is going to be the only option. And it may take less time for them to move, establish residency, and get a divorce than it will take to get potentially full marriage equality in Pennsylvania. Even if our cases that are pending are successful here, there's probably going to be a period of time where there's an appeal that may take a whole nother year.
Is the LGBT community very active or vocal on the issue of gay divorce, or is the focus still gay marriage equality above all?
Well, I think divorce is part of marriage equality. You know, I think the rights and responsibilities that come with marriage become most significant when there is a breakdown or a tragedy. So, you know, death, disability, and dissolution are the three different issues that make your marital status very significant. So I do think it's part of the conversation, although I think it's something a lot of people don't want to think about and talk about. Nobody goes into a marriage thinking that they're going to break up. But the unfortunate reality is that, you know, the divorce rate for heterosexual couples is about 50%, and I imagine it's probably going to be the same for same-sex couples. So half of all these people that are rushing off to get married, their relationships may not last, and they're going to have to be looking at divorce at some point in the future.
Tiffany Palmer, thank you for your time and your explanation.
You're welcome.
Tiffany Palmer is a lawyer in Philadelphia who specializes in legal issues around gay adoption, gay marriage, and now gay divorce. As we mentioned earlier, a Pennsylvania court lifted its ban on same-sex marriage earlier this very week, paving the way for Robin to get a divorce without having to leave the state. Now, Tiffany emailed us and said that she just filed her first divorce case in Bucks County. Still, same-sex couples risk wedlock in 32 other states. There's more on the Pennsylvania ruling and on same-sex divorce in general. All that, wordofmouthradio.org. Well, as we've heard today, the subject of weddings and of marriage in general can be divisive. Between the multi-billion-dollar wedding industry, the expectations of family and friends, and the cultural pressure to conform or the desire to rebel, it's hard to say much about matrimony that everybody can agree with. That's why we decided to end our show today with a perspective that is both intimately connected to the joy and hope of a wedding, yet a little bit of an outsider, the always at arm's length perspective of a longtime wedding photographer. Matt Mendelson is a writer, professional photographer, and a bit of a wedding philosopher, we found. In hopes of better understanding the deeper meaning behind his job, he caught up with a number of old clients to see how they were faring years after the big day. He wrote about the experience for The Washingtonian. I have a friend who was a couples therapist for a long time who said that she could tell pretty much in the first visit whether or not this couple was going to make it. Do you ever speculate about a couple's chances for a lasting marriage when you photograph their wedding?
I mean, I think we all do. I think not just the photographer, but every person who is a guest at the wedding is secretly doing the same thing.
Laying odds?
Not as a blood sport, but just sort of in the back of your mind, you wonder. I sort of giggle because I have a lot of Facebook friends who are fellow wedding photographers. And so every Saturday, I see a stream of Facebook posts that say something to the effect of, "So honored to be shooting John and Stacy's wedding today." And I always say to myself, why are you honored? You don't really know them at all. You don't really know your clients, and you don't know whether they're going to be divorced or end up in a DEA drug raid, as one of my clients did, or dying, as some of my clients have done. You're just looking at them, and they come into your studio for an hour or an hour and a half, and you instantly think, now they are my clients, they must all be great, and they must all be destined for a long, wonderful marriage. And it's kind of like shooting the coin flip before a football game and leaving and thinking, I've got enough. Well, that's just the coin flip. The game hasn't actually started yet. And so to make all these assumptions based on a one-hour meeting in your studio and a one-day wedding, you're bound to be wrong.
How about what you produce, though, Matt? You're presenting people with an image of their best self or their projected best self, right? And after reconnecting with these five couples, did you feel like the photographs that you made held more or less importance than you imagined when making them? Or did they play any role at all for the brides or grooms that they captured?
I think people love the pictures that I take, and I love the pictures that I make at their weddings. And I think they're important. I guess what the story was meant to do is to make people realize that you go in, let's say I go into a wedding and I shoot 5,000 frames, and those frames get edited down to 1,500 that the couple will see. And of those 1,500, they might choose 60 for a wedding album. And of those 60, one or two of them actually gets printed out and stuck into a 5x7 frame. That one picture out of that original 5,000 will really be the only one that stands the test of time and that will be handed down over the years and left in an attic box and found by great-grandchildren. So for all of these thousands of pictures we as photographers take, it really becomes one image that will last 100 years or 200 years if we're all lucky. But, I don't know.
Well, on that bittersweet but ultimately authentic note, we conclude today's ceremony. The reception begins right now at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us, send us your feedback, or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, the best wedding stories and lots of other great stuff gets passed around by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Join us for more on Saturday at noon, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.